It's the confluence where the news comes together. I'm Kevin Gavin. Coming up, the Senate Republican leadership unveils its plan to replace the Affordable Care Act, and county leaders are getting ready to vote on the final leg of the Mon Fayette Expressway. But first, this week, the state issued a dozen licenses for growers, processors of medical marijuana. We're going to talk about the process of legalizing and implementing the new medical marijuana law. Joining us in studio is Sarah Ann Hughes, reporter for The Incline. Welcome, Sarah.
Thanks for having me.
And Liz Reed, health science and technology reporter for WESA. Liz, welcome back.
Thanks for having me, Kevin.
If you have a question or comment, tweet us. Use the hashtag WESAConfluence. All right, so let's start with, again, 12 were selected. What do we know about the selection process? Do we know how many applied in addition to those 12? But let's talk about the selection process.
I actually don't recall. Do you recall the exact number of how many that applied?
Yeah, it's more than 400.
So 400 applied for 12 licenses.
Sure.
Okay,
yes.
So let's talk about what do we know about how they were chosen?
Well, there was a whole bunch of criteria. I'll just run down a few of them. They had to have a plan for diversity, so ensuring diversity in leadership and employment, things like that. And a lot of it has to do with sort of security, so like physical security of the physical growing spaces, inventory management, storage, packaging and labeling. So they basically had to put together a full plan, and then they had a score on each of these. There was about two dozen different categories, and then they got a score and they added up the score, and the top scores got the licenses, basically.
Do we know who did the selection and their background, or is that a little bit murky?
Sure, we kind of know. We know that they work for the State Department of Health. But John Collins, who is the director of the Office of Medical Marijuana, declined to give reporters who asked any additional information about them, saying essentially, we want to preserve their privacy. We don't want people, you know, digging into them and sort of questioning them.
And interestingly, wouldn't even answer the question of if they were vetted for conflicts of interest.
So hold it. So there's a lack of transparency there, obviously, about not naming who selected these 12.
A little bit. I mean, so the reason why they didn't want to give their names is because they didn't want them to be influenced in any way. And these first 12, these are just the first 12. There will be potentially more grower processor licenses given out.
So, okay, so the implication is that the same selectors will do a future, or at least the possibility of such, that they could be.
As far as we know, yeah.
So, okay. So now, one of those, so how many? So 12, I said. 12. How were they divided up around this state? What was that? Was there, you know, was the state divided up into areas or what? Sarah Ann?
Sure. So the state was divided into six regions. Allegheny County is located in the southwest region. And for grower processors, each region got two grower processor permits in this first phase of rollout. So it was evenly distributed across the state.
Okay, so we have six, we have 12 divided by six, so two in this area. One of those selected was PurePenn and CEO Gay Perlow. Senator Jim Brewster, he is a state senator, Democrat from McKeesport, and that was the area, and his district includes that area of PurePenn and Gay Perlow. And he said he was excited to hear the news.
The fact that it's going into the city of McKeesport on a former mill site is just part of the development we're trying to do in the city and in the region. But I think the most important point is that this is a medical issue. It's going to help thousands of people who are enduring pain and different diseases and different medical requirements that they currently need and can't get the help they need.
So Senator Brewster brings up a couple of very different points: the economic impact, and of course, the whole reason that the legislation was passed in the first place, the health benefit. But what do we know? Do we know anything, any projections about economic impact of the whole medical marijuana business? Any numbers being floated around?
The only numbers I have are John Collins, the director of the State Office of Medical Marijuana, sort of hypothesized that each grower processor might hire between 40 and 60 people. Now, Gabriel Perlow, who is the guy behind PurePenn in McKeesport, he said that at full capacity, they could hire up to 100 people. So that's well above that estimate from John Collins.
Okay, and that's strictly the grower processors, and of course the, dare I say, the trickle down when we get to the dispensaries, which is coming up a little bit later.
Yeah, and that's what's been granted is 12, and there can be up to 25 in the state. So the initial, how Gabriel explained it to me is it's going to be in phases, so they're not going to be running at their full potential right away. So they might hire like 50 people right away, then double that to 100 in the future. And then you think about the grower processors that are going to be up and running by the end of this year, early next year. There's going to be potentially twice as many grower processors total. There can be 25 in the state. So it's going to be probably years before we can even know the full economic impact.
Sure. And as I said, we know a little bit about Jobs. AgriMed, which is the other company that got a permit for a grower processor in our region, they're estimating that they're going to invest $25 million initially to develop the their site in Greene County. And they also are estimating about 62 jobs. So that's about in line with what the state is saying.
Okay. Now, the next step for these grower processors is to prove that they can be operational before they get the go ahead to actually grow the marijuana for medical uses. We mentioned Gabe Perlow, CEO of PurePen. Liz, you said you talked to him. He's the director of the Office of Medical Marijuana. He said that the director of the Medical Marijuana Office indicated that they would be sending out a checklist.
Well, no, that was actually Gabriel Perlow.
Yeah, he indicated the director would send out might send out a checklist. Let's hear from Gabe Perlow.
But logic would dictate that would include the security being properly implemented, all of your transportation being accommodated, and then all of the cultivation, sanitation, waste disposal, and laboratory elements of our facility being operational and being ready to begin processing.
Yeah, so it's basically going to be executing everything in the plan that they submitted to the state except the growing.
Is that the easy part or what?
The growing? Yeah. And potentially, yeah. Okay. I'm not an expert on that side of it.
Okay. Now, I want to get a picture of what are we looking at? Are we looking at a farm outside of in McKeesport? And where's the other one based, Sarah Ann, that you said?
In Carmichael's in Greene County.
Okay.
And then we should mention, too, there's one in Lawrence County, which is technically in the northwest region, but is really close to
Yeah, and it still would be considered a Pittsburgh area as well, just how they were divided. They were not included in the southwest region. So what are they going to look like? As I said, a farm? No farm? Is this some sort of incubator? What are we looking at here?
Yeah, so as Liz mentioned earlier, there are really, really strict regulations in place for grower processors. They will not be outside. This will not look like a farm. It has to be an indoor, secure facility. I know that the people who applied that I spoke to talked about their security plans being one of the most important things they worked on, sort of proving to the state that, yes, our security will be secure. No one will be able to break in. The alarm system, I mean, that's a huge part of proving to the state that you can be operational.
So it's nobody can sort of sneak onto a farm and snip off some plants.
Right, right.
Okay.
And I mean, we've been able to see pictures of what these grow houses look like in places like California and Colorado. And they basically just look like warehouses with rows of marijuana plant and lots of lights. I'm sure these electricity bills are going to be through the roof. It'd be interesting to see if anyone's pursuing solar or anything like that. And then the processing part, I would imagine it's going to look somewhat industrial, somewhat like a science lab. You know, they need equipment to extract the THC out of the actual plant. There's different ways you can do that with CO2, with butane, but yeah, it's going to look like an indoor farm in one part and probably like a science lab in another part.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about the process, if you would, and the reason why they're doing that, because medical marijuana is only going to be allowed in what forms?
So oils, tinctures, vaporizer liquids, creams, things like that. So the dry leaf form, the kind you would like roll up into a joint is not legal right now.
Okay. Sarah Ann, do we know how difficult of a process this processing is in terms of, getting it from the plant to these oils, these tinctures and all that?
Yeah.
I mean, it's been done, obviously, in plenty of other states.
Exactly. And the grower processors we're talking about are not, you know, they're not home growers. These are professional companies that have onboarded people, you know, from all over the country who know how to do this, who have the process sort of down pat. So there are a lot of regulations in place from what fertilizers you can use to, you know, what you can actually extract from the plant. But again, you know, Pennsylvania is not the first to do this, and the process is already pretty much in place.
Yeah, I mean, these extractions, so basically, because you can't sell the dry leaf, you've got to get the THC and the CBD out of the leaf. Those are like the sort of active ingredients.
That make you high.
The THC makes you high.
Yeah, THC.
The CBD makes you, is believed to be the sort of pain-relieving agent.
Okay.
So you've got to get those out of the leaf, right? So there's extraction methods. You can use CO2, you can use butane, or you can use ethanol. It depends what you're making, what kind of thing you're making, whether you're making a vaporizer liquid versus a cream versus a tincture. That's going to dictate probably what's the most efficient way to extract it. They're like these big machines.
Okay.
So they're big boxes. You put it, I'm assuming you put the marijuana in one end and you get
the
extraction.
Oil.
Yeah, sort of.
It's the Confluence, and we're talking about the latest step in the implementation of the medical marijuana law in Pennsylvania. 12 licenses for growers, processors were issued this week, and that leads us to the next step, dispensary. So what's happening? That's going to happen pretty soon, too, isn't it, Sarah Ann?
Yep. The state has said that they are going to release the names of the companies that are getting the first 27 permits by the end of this month. So perhaps next week we'll know. As I said, there are 27 permits. The Southwest region, again, which includes Allegheny County, is going to get 5. The most permits that any region will get will be 10 in the Southeast, where Philadelphia is located.
And it's because you would think there'd be the most need in those just because they're more heavily populated?
I imagine they're looking at like a per capita.
Right.
Exactly. Yeah. Health officials have said essentially it's based on potential patient access. And I should say that for the grower processors, each region got 2 permits each. The dispensaries, it's a little bit more specific. For example, of the 5 permits that have to go in the Southwest region, 2 will go to Allegheny County. So that means that they can't all be concentrated in Pittsburgh, for example.
So are there just going to be like, so the 2 that Sarah Ann mentioned, so it's just going to be 2 locations in Allegheny County?
Yeah, so there's going to be, let's break it back to statewide. There's going to be 27 permittees. Each of those permittees can have up to 3 locations.
Okay.
Now, John Collins, again, the director of the Office of Medical Marijuana, indicated last week that he believes the 27 will be granted, but that doesn't mean the 81, 27 times 3, the 81 locations will be granted. So that's yet to be seen how many actual storefronts we're going to see. So in theory, could have up to 6 in Allegheny County. We don't know if that's going to happen right off the bat, though.
Right. And one of the rules is that, let's say your primary dispensary is in Allegheny County, you cannot open one of your 2 other dispensaries in Allegheny County. It has to be in another county in the region, which is another way that the state is trying to prevent them from all getting bunched in one place.
All right. And is the 27, quote, the final number, or could that expand as well, just like the number of growers?
Up to 50. So you could see 150 storefronts statewide.
Okay. So, as you mentioned before, what are the legal forms of medical marijuana? What are the approved medical? Now, Senator Daylon Leach, talked to him at the what conference?
He was on a panel at the World Cannabis Expo. I might be messing that
back
up, but
in
that's
April.
The gist of it. Yeah, back in April, that was here in Pittsburgh.
And now, let's be fair. Daylon Leach is the foremost advocate of medical marijuana.
And recreational.
And as well. And he has said that leaf marijuana for medical purposes could happen.
But they will, because we're appointing people to do that. They will recommend that at latest by April 17th, which means when dispensaries open, it is likely that they will have whole plant on their shelves from day one.
So we have, yeah, like you said, he comes from a particular point of view. But when he says, but they will, he's talking about an advisory board who by April of next year has the option of they're tasked with the job of reviewing the forms of marijuana that are approved, and they can potentially add forms. He obviously believes they're going to add what is called the dry leaf. form.
Is there any legislation at this point to expand the forms?
Well, that's included. This advisory council is included in the legislation. So that would be more on the regulatory side, less on the legislative side.
So let me clarify that. So the council could advise and the recommendations are adopted? And would it be the Department of Health adopting them or what?
Yeah, as far as I know, that's how it would work in theory. That Senator Leach seems to be confident that's what will happen.
Yep. No, Liz is exactly right. The advisory board is going to make recommendations to the State Department of Health, which can choose to accept them.
Okay. In our remaining 2 minutes, I want to get to the next step after dispensaries is also the physicians. And they are not necessarily prescribed. They are allowed to sign up to be part of this, if you would. But they're not prescribing, they are recommending. What's the difference here?
So the word prescribe has a federal definition, and that applies to drugs that are FDA approved and are basically not Schedule One drugs. A Schedule One drug is a drug that the DEA says has no medical use and high potential for abuse. Marijuana is a Schedule One drug, according to the federal government. So it's illegal to prescribe a Schedule One drug. Doctors could lose their prescribing privileges. So the way there was a year 2000 court ruling in U.S. District Courts that said the feds can't sanction doctors who recommend marijuana. So that's sort of the way to get around it. It's not officially a prescription.
Sarah Ann, what's next? Those are some of the next steps. Any other steps we should look forward to?
Yeah, so in July, the Department of Health is expected to release the physician registry. So essentially, if you are a doctor in the state who treats one of these 17 serious medical conditions that qualifies for medical marijuana, you'll be able to put your name on the registry, sign up for a four-hour training course, and then you will, with approval from the Department of Health, be able to make this recommendation.
All right. Sarah Ann Hughes is a reporter for The Incline. Liz Reed is health and science reporter for WESA. Thanks to both of you.
Thanks so much.
Thanks for inviting me, Kevin.
Reaction among Pennsylvania lawmakers to the Senate Republicans' health care plan. Not surprising. Plus, will construction resume on the 3-decade-old Mon-Fayette Expressway? That's when the confluence continues on 90.5 WESA.
Here's what's trending in Pittsburgh. I'm Katie Zolkowski. A West Coast sport with a funny name is growing in popularity right here in Pittsburgh. Pickleball. You heard it right. It's a racket sport similar to tennis and played with a green wiffle ball. The Pickleball Classic is currently underway at the Convention Center. And a new report finds Penn State University's tuition has gone up 500% in the last 3 decades. The State Auditor General urged the school to lower costs. Find more top news at WESA.fm.
It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Coming up later in the program, the Senate Republican plan to replace Obamacare. First, we're going to talk about two big transportation projects in this area, the Mon-Fayette Expressway and the Bus Rapid Transit Project. Joining us in studio, Margaret J. Krause is WESA's transportation development reporter. Welcome, Margaret.
Thanks, Kevin.
And Ryan Dito, who covers transportation issues, among other ideas, for Pittsburgh City Paper. Good to see you again, Ryan.
Great to be here.
And if you have a question or comment, you can tweet us. Please use the hashtag WESAConfluence. Let's start with the Mon-Fayette Expressway, since it's the much older of the two of these projects we're going to talk about. So, Ryan, let's go back a little bit of background. I believe the actual construction on the Mon-Fayette Expressway began in 88, was it?
Well, the law was actually passed in 86 that would require the state to construct the Mon-Fayette, among many other projects that are associated with the Turnpike. I believe it started then, and they started all the way from Fayette County, and it actually extends all the way up from Fayette County, and it stops at, I believe, in Jefferson Township at the southern tip of Allegheny County.
And, of course, the overall goal of the Mon-Fayette was to link just outside of Morgantown with Pittsburgh, whether it got to Monroeville and stopped Monroeville or even closer to the sea, which is another aspect of the story.
it was supposed to be a project that was meant to revitalize basically the Mon Valley, to, you know, connect the industry there, to give better transportation to the, you know, industries that were in that area, whether they're heavy industry, coal, these kind of things. It hasn't really worked out that way. It's not like that area is booming in terms of industry thanks to the Mon Fayette, but the Mon Fayette is there.
Is the answer to this, to either of you, it's because the full thing has not been completed. It has stopped at Route 51 in Jefferson. It hasn't made its way to Monroeville or even closer to Pittsburgh. Is that the excuse that it has not boomed, or is it just what do we heard?
That's an excuse. I don't know if that has any merit in terms of highway design or in terms of any actual connection, especially because this proposed connection is just going to Monroeville. It's not actually – most of the time you want highways to connect directly into the biggest city centers, like 279, which a lot of people talk about how Highway 279 – or sorry, Interstate 279
right.
connects to Cranberry basically to – downtown Pittsburgh, which has led to a boom in that area. It has helped unlock that area. This highway is not connecting to downtown Pittsburgh. It's connecting to Monroeville, which is a suburb, which has had its own maybe boom and bust kind of situation right. from having a highway, you know, connected to it. So I think the jury's really still out in terms of how effective that will be.
Right. And the part that sort of, I guess, disinterested some who might have been more supportive earlier on was there was supposed to be a spur from Monroeville to the city of Pittsburgh, but that got nixed for various reasons, political reasons, whether it was going through.
Yeah, it was also really, really expensive, and most mayors in the area, you know, were totally against it, including John Fetterman in Braddock.
Right, Braddock.
And ironically, that actual section that got the nixed area is actually seeing some of the most exciting development in the city right now at the Almono site. So where they're trying to do a more less highway-y kind of, you know, development and have a complete streets model and have driverless cars and have bikes and have all those things. So I think that's where you had, you know, Peduto and Fitzgerald, who sit on the SBC commission to make the decision, say, well, we don't really want to go in this direction. Recently, Fitzgerald flipped the switch. But, you know, that's because, you know, I think he realized that the law requires the state. It requires the state to build the Mon Fayette.
Well, speaking of the Southwest Pennsylvania Commission and Rich Fitzgerald, I spoke with him earlier this week because the Southwest Pennsylvania Commission is to vote Monday on whether to actually build this final leg of the Mon Fayette Expressway, because back in March they tabled it, waiting for a state answer about whether they could use the money for other purposes. So Rich Fitzgerald, he told me on Monday that he's going to vote for it because it's important to keep the transportation project in the region.
That was the other thing. We wanted to make sure that money stayed in the Mon Valley, the Mon Fayette area, with some of the challenges that are existing there economically. So that was a big part of our decision as well.
All right. So they tabled it in March because they weren't really convinced that it was the best use of $2.2 billion. They might have something that might be more practical, whether it was bus lanes or this or mass transit or something like this. And the answer they got from the state legislature was no.
Well, they do have other projects in the area that, you know, like what we're going to talk, you know, we're going to talk about the BRT a little bit later, that seem like a better purpose for the money, but they can't spend it. Like Act 61 of 1985 says that they have to spend it on certain projects that are already written down, that were written down 30 years ago, that they have to commit
to. And these are turnpike projects.
They're turnpike projects. They have to go through the turnpike. If we passed on not building the Mon Fayette here, the next project is actually a highway extension from Route 80 up through Bradford in McKean County that would make an expressway in the middle of McKean County for some reason, which is one of the most least dense counties in all of Pennsylvania. So these are the kind of projects that I think critics have argued that these projects are incredibly antiquated, that they basically were constructed to give money into districts that normally weren't getting it. But they also face a lot of community opposition. Another project on the list is an extension from Freedom, PA, up in Beaver County, over to the Turnpike. That has already been proposed, and a lot of people in that community actually hate that project. They don't want to see that go through. But this is the problem with the law, is that they have to construct these things, and it's going to take the state legislator to say, no, we have to, like, you know, get rid of that law. But that would take someone like State Senator Brewster, right, saying, no, I don't want to have this money come into my district because this is a bad law, and I don't think they're willing to do that.
Right. And final point on the Monfayette Expressway, Mr. Fitzgerald told me that basically it's a use it or lose it at this point. And I asked him if there was any legislation being floated around to do that, to change the law so that they could have more flexibility. He said nothing is being floated.
Yeah.
All right, so let's talk about another project. No, it's not $2 billion. It's Margaret J. Krause, a transportation reporter for WESA. We're talking, what, $230-some
million? $233
million. For bus rapid transit. Again, yes. Update us where this is, where would it go, and where would it extend to possibly?
Sure. So the idea, the locally preferred alternative that was chosen in terms of a route would run from downtown to Oakland and then continue from Oakland. The core would continue on the East Busway through to Wilkinsburg and beyond. And then the two branches, one would go to Highland Park, the other would go Squirrel Hill Greenfield.
So originally there was just the bare bones, but what they're going to submit is the ones with sort of those branches.
Yes, and it's got a great name, Core Plus 2, which sounds like a fitness program waiting to happen.
It's going to get everyone taking public transportation. That was the most extensive options of all of them. I think that also made sense in terms of the less amount of transfers that people would have to take if they were riding from Squirrel Hill or Highland Park, or even if they're riding from Braddock or other areas like that.
Okay, so the core, Oakland, Pitt, downtown. What are we talking about? I mean, we're talking, what, Fifth, Forbes?
Fifth and Forbes, so it's still counterflow the way that it is now. One of the proposals that was floated would have been both directions on one of the arteries, but it's still going to be counterflow. So on Fifth and Forbes, it will go down to downtown and turn around. They will be on dedicated lanes.
Okay, so that Core Plus 2 was a result of actually earlier community input, was it not? They asked for, no, don't just stop at Oak. We need to go further out. We need to go to Highland Park. We need to go branching elsewhere to Greenfield and Squirrel Hill.
Yes, one of the things that was emphasized on Tuesday night, there is a public input meeting in Uptown to talk about station locations and street design. One of the things they emphasized, that the city planner that was there and an analyst for the Port Authority, was that there had been significant community input and that they are reflecting back what the community wants.
Okay. So let's talk about those public input sessions. You attended, and you spoke with Betty Alexander. She's a resident of Stanton Heights. She told you that she was worried that the BRT, Bus Rapid Transit, would make it more difficult for people to get downtown.
That's the way it seemed. Like, people could not come into town, you know, because the bus was only going to go into Oakland, and they have to transfer, and they weren't going to have a lot of buses coming into downtown Pittsburgh, which I thought was discriminatory to the poor.
So was there a misconception here, or a lack of awareness, a lack of understanding, not good explaining by the authorities?
Well, I think any time that you do a project this big, it takes a while for the information to permeate. Even if you go to a community meeting once or twice, sometimes there's just so much going on. Maybe it doesn't get correctly transferred. So her concern was that this would knock out, and a lot of the concerns that were raised at that meeting is that BRT is going to hurt service on other lines. Her buses run down Liberty and so won't be affected, but some buses will stop in Oakland. People will have to transfer, which, if you have a physical disability, if you're low income, a new transfer cost or a new mobility cost is a big deal.
Yeah, I actually wrote about this issue. It can be a problem for people who are out in the outer communities that would ride, like the 61, for example, would probably be the biggest hit route that goes.
61 starts where?
Starts in Duquesne, I believe.
Okay.
And then it runs through Braddock and Homestead, and then it connects through Squirrel Hill and then through Oakland. So they would probably reroute something that would have a route that would start in Duquesne and then just terminate in Oakland. And then those riders who normally would just get to ride the 61 all the way downtown are most likely going to have to transfer. And so is that transfer going to be free? That's what advocates are asking for. Is it going to be a nice station for them to, you know, rest at while they wait for the other bus? These are the questions that I think you're right, are starting to become brought up more. I think a lot more people were just very, you know, concerned with the whole design of the project in the beginning. And now they're kind of like, oh, wait, what about this transfer issue?
Right. And the Port Authority, one of the things that they're emphasizing is they're applying for federal funding in September, despite uncertainty about whether or not that will be available to them. But in order to submit that grant in September, they have to be able to say, here's where the stations are going to go. Here's what the streets are going to look like. And so though the planners at this meeting and in other interviews have said they are concerned about this one seat ride, which is you're in an outer community and you can just take one bus without having to transfer all the way in, that affects on other service. Though they're concerned about that, they're sort of tabling them for now because it's not the most immediate priority. But a lot of people at meetings and interviews are saying, okay, that's all well and good, but seriously, please let me know if I'm going to have to change my whole life because of what you intend to do.
And I think that's really interesting because I think that issue has kind of been pushed back to the side there. A lot of critics of this project say that it's really more about development than it is about actual, making it better for people to ride, because this could potentially unlock a slew of development in uptown, basically transform the whole neighborhood, because you'd have these nice stations. You'd have quick transit on new, dedicated buses, basically. And, anyone who's, ridden through uptown can see that there's basically just like parking lots that are totally undeveloped, that, don't have the, kind of big projects that are. Right.
Okay, we have 1 minute left. And we started off this part of the conversation with the price tag of $233 million. What are they looking for from the feds in terms of that $233 million? And what are the chances, considering some of the budget proposals we've been seeing?
Sure. Robert Rubenstein is the executive director of the Urban Redevelopment Authority, and he told me they were looking anywhere from $80 to $100 million, which is a huge chunk of this price tag. President Trump's proposed budget would not allow new projects, which the BRT would be one, to be eligible under the capital investment grant, a small starts grant. And without that money, it's unclear what they would do to make up that funding.
Yeah, they would have to try to raise it locally, which is not something that Western Pennsylvania has, typically done. It would be very difficult. You'd have to get the 10-county region to kind of buy into a big little tax upgrade that would like help fund it. And I think that's yet to be seen that that's actually a possibility.
Ryan Dito is a reporter for Pittsburgh City Paper, covers transportation issues. Margaret J. Krause is WESA's transportation and development reporter. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thanks, Kevin.
Thanks.
Mean-spirited or fulfilling a campaign promise? We'll discuss reaction to the Senate Republicans' health care plan when the confluence continues on 90.5 WESA.
Katie Blackley with the Pittsburgh Almanac. This week in history, the first Nickelodeon Theater opens in downtown Pittsburgh in 1905. The building on Smithfield Street, where owners charged a nickel to see a 15-minute moving picture show, is considered to be one of the first modern movie theaters in the country. That's this week's Pittsburgh Almanac for June 23rd, 2017.
It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Senate Republicans released their long-awaited health care bill Thursday in Washington. A Senate GOP health bill represents the party's long-awaited attempt to scuttle much of the Obamacare law. Joining us in studio now is senior WESA reporter Mark Newpar, who covers government and politics. Mark, welcome.
Thank you very much, Kevin.
Mark, it's healthcare, but there are definite aspects of government and politics on this issue. Government, how much should government be involved in such an issue? and also politics. It's a very partisan issue. Let's start with that.
Yeah, to the extreme, it is. You talk to Democrats, you talk to liberal think tanks, and this is just the worst thing ever. Everyone is going to be sick. Nobody is going to have insurance. The interesting part, though, Kevin, is when you talk to Republicans, they're not running around saying it's the best thing ever, but they are at least, for the most part, defending it.
All right. And we're going to hear from both a Democrat and a Republican momentarily, but little details about this. So the bill would cut Medicaid. It would end penalties for people not buying insurance and erase a bunch of tax increases as part of the long-awaited health care bill. Lawmakers in Pennsylvania were quick to react to this. You talked to Congressman Mike Doyle, and he says it's a tax cut bill masquerading as health care legislation.
They have basically stripped all the taxes out of the ACA, and they're going to use that money to fund their tax bill. So it just seems particularly mean-spirited to me.
Yeah, it takes about $600 billion that were put into the budget for the financing of the ACA, gets rid of nearly all of that, and that's why he's calling it masquerading as a healthcare bill, but it's actually a tax cut bill. He is very much, Mike Doyle, is very much against this, says he was going to fight it. He's going to educate, he says, the people that live in his district so they know what's coming along, and he believes, as I spoke to him, that the Republicans don't even really like this and know that it's going to be a tough one because they are not having everything phase in until after the 2018 midterm elections.
Okay, so that's when the pain begins?
Yes, he does call it the pain, indeed.
Okay, so the tax cuts, would there be such an uproar if it was sort of across the board, people benefiting from tax cuts, because the implication is the wealthy or some... It'll be a limited few who will benefit from these tax cuts.
Yeah, I've seen some people calling it, you know, kind of the reverse Robin Hood, where it's taking from the poor and giving to the rich. But I really think, Kevin, that the debate that Mike Doyle is trying to make about that tax is really not going to gain that much traction. It is really going to be about what is going on with Medicaid and what is happening with just this idea of single payer sometime in the future healthcare.
All right. Speaking of Medicaid, governors in several states, including Pennsylvania's Tom Wolf, that opted to expand Medicaid under former President Barack Obama's law, they're wary about this. They're upset about these Medicaid cuts. The Senate plan calls for a slower phase out of the Medicaid expansion, as you alluded to, than the House passed version. Here's Pennsylvania U.S. Senator Pat Toomey.
If Governor Wolf is sincere about how important this is, one assumes that he would be willing to pay a fair share for this. The federal government's going to pay a majority of the cost if this bill is enacted. Why would he threaten to throw these people off Medicaid unless he feels it's not worth it to provide Medicaid for them, even when he can have it for less than half the cost?
Yeah, let me roll that back. First of all, let me tell you that was part of a conference call with several reporters on it, and that's why that sound was a little bit wonky in there. But what's basically going on is that under Obamacare, the Medicaid expansion to put more people onto Medicaid, the states were told, we will give you 90 cents on the dollar rather than the more customary 50 cents on the dollar to expand it to some able-bodied individuals that don't have children that would not have gotten onto Medicaid in the past. What the Republican plan calls for is rolling that 90% slowly back down to 50% where it is elsewhere. And that's where Toomey is really coming out saying, hey, Governor, you think this is so important, then fund it with state dollars.
I think we've heard from the Wolf administration, this was actually in reaction to the House plan,
right,
that it would cost the state $2 billion.
That is a number that I've seen. It's kind of hard to say exactly what that number is, but $2 billion seems like a number which is a lot considering what type of a hit that would take on a state budget that is already out of balance.
All right. Just a minute or so left, Mark. I'm going to talk about... We know that four Republican senators are not on board, how much they disagree with this plan, but that is enough to scuttle the plan if they can't be appeased, if you would. What about Senator Toomey?
Senator Toomey is on board at this point. He says that he is continuing to look at it, but thinks he favors it. He was a member of the group of 13 that really kind of put this plan together, but he says he didn't see the actual final things until the morning that the bill was introduced. So he wants to see some changes on it, but he was not specific as to what those changes would be.
Okay, so he's not saying specifically.
I'd put him in the yes column, though.
Yes, okay. Timeline? What's the process?
So they have opted to fast-track this, which means it does not have to go through committee. It will go directly to the Senate floor, needs 20 hours of debate. They're expecting to get a CBO score, a budget score, how much this will actually cost over the next 10 years. On Monday, they could have 20 hours of debate and actually vote on this thing by the end of the week, that is, if the Republicans want to call it, if they can figure out how to get their 50 votes.
They're going to have to do their counting before they call it for a
Absolutely.
Vote. Absolutely. All right. Mark Neupar is WESA senior reporter. He covers government and politics. Mark, thank you so much.
Absolutely.
July 1, a week from tomorrow, marks the beginning of a new fiscal year in Pennsylvania. The state house quickly passed the budget along party lines. The process is in the state Senate right now. We're going to get an update from Katie Meyer. Katie is the Capitol Bureau Chief for WESA and for public radio stations across the Commonwealth. Katie, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So, Katie, give us the update. Where is the Senate in crafting a budget at this point?
Well, sometimes I think your guess is as good as mine on that. We have seen a few different proposals, but nothing concrete yet from the Senate. Possibly by the beginning of next week, we'll have more details. But, you know, the consensus around here, and I guess the general feeling, I would say, is that, you know, we know less right now than we did this time last year. And, you know, last year's budget was a couple weeks late. It sort of seems like there's not a ton of urgency almost among lawmakers right now. Obviously, they say they do care about this. They're trying to get it out by the due date. But, you know, it seems, I think the general feeling is that if they get it within a couple of weeks of the deadline, that's more or less good enough.
Now, according to Senate Minority Leader Jay Costa from Allegheny County, he said that he and other Dems haven't so far been party to many of the budget negotiations. That's not unusual for the minority party to be left out, especially if their votes aren't even needed for passage, right?
Right, that's correct. You know, we've seen this in previous years as well with GOP majorities. Right now, it is mostly, you know, I think the Senate's been in a lot of negotiations within its own caucus, the Senate GOP. We have seen negotiation between the House and Senate caucuses. You know, there is, I think, some frustration between the caucuses, too. The House is essentially saying, you know, we put out our recommendations, we put out our plan, you know, the Senate needs to come up with something as well. So, yeah, and again, I said, you know, maybe early next week we could see something a little bit more concrete from them.
You mentioned some talks between the Senate and the House, which we said earlier had quickly passed their version of the budget. Any concrete negotiations between the Senate and the governor?
They have, I think, been speaking. It doesn't seem like there has been too much productive conversation that's happened. Governor Tom Wolf is still, you know, he's not pushing for broad-based taxes anymore. That he kind of jettisoned that idea very early in the process, early this year. But he is still saying he would like a severance tax on natural gas, and that's something both the House and Senate Republicans have given a strong no. They do not want to do that. It seems very unlikely that that will happen. So the governor, really, his tone that he's taken on this is that we need renewable, you know, revenue, year-by-year revenue, and that a lot of the plans that the House and Senate have come up with or are talking about really don't give us that renewable revenue. The biggest proposal right now has been an expansion of gaming. The House passed sort of an omnibus gaming bill that would have you know, legalized iGaming, that's one of the big ones, and also, more contentiously, legalized video gaming terminals in like bars and taverns and other places with liquor licenses across the state. And so that's something that the Senate has been very lukewarm on. It doesn't seem like there's support there to pass that portion of the bill, so they're looking at a more limited one. But, you know, wherever they land on that, that seems like it's going to be the main source of any, you know, renewable revenue that we're going to get. And the governor doesn't seem to think that that's enough.
Speaking of revenues, those yeah. options that you were just floating about, what the House has done and the Senate being lukewarm to them in the expansion of gaming, is this for the new budget? And I also wanted you to address the current budget hole, the deficit that we're running, which, what is it, about $1.5
billion? Yeah, you know, there's different estimates that you get. But the current budget hole, well, first of all, the shortfall from this past budget is about $1.5 billion. So that's, you know, money that was budgeted for, but the revenue did not come through. So that's a hole that they have to fix before anything can happen, and that's, you know, kind of one-time money there. And then there's an additional, you know, some estimates have it higher, but depending on their spend number, an additional $700 million or so that then they would have to come up with. And that also that doesn't really factor in the structural deficit, which has been projected to be more than somewhere around $3 billion. So that's sort of, that's like the long-term deficit that we have, a multi-year one. So, yeah, there's basically $1.5 billion with a B from last year, plus an additional $700 million to get us up to the spend number that they appear to have more or less settled on.
And these have to be sustainable, ongoing revenue sources as opposed to one-time fixes?
You know, that's ideal, that the revenue would come back year after year. Now, what they've been talking about, and again, this is not definite yet, but one of the ideas that's been kicking around is taking out a loan. Basically, the plan, again, this is not definite, but that, you know, leasing state assets to a private company or something, using that state program to leverage an upfront loan and then paying that back long-term with interest, which would be high. And so that's sort of been an unpopular plan if it's been brought up in the past, but now it is getting some serious consideration.
So are... With aside from short revenue shortfall for this year, when it comes to the 17-18 fiscal budget, the 18 fiscal budget, are they looking, because of this revenue challenge, shall we say, looking to trim further, cut back on Governor Wolf's overall spending plan? Do we know a figure that's being floated as a total expenditure plan by the Senate?
Yeah, we have a general figure worth saying. Governor Wolf's spending plan that he put out in like February of this year was higher than his previous budget, but not by too much. It was generally thought to be a very austere proposal. House Republicans, when they put out their own number, that was $31.5 billion. So that was an additional, I think, $800 million below. The number that we're hearing right now is $31.8 billion, a little bit higher, but still a very, you know, a thrifty budget. And they do appear to be closer on a spend number than they do on deciding on revenues to balance that out. So, yeah, I would say 31.8 is the number we're hearing most frequently at this moment.
All right, just less than a minute left, Katie. I want to get you. Senator Costa, the Democratic leader, told you, he says he thinks it's possible the spending plan will be in place by June 30, but the revenue plan, which is obviously a key component, might take a little bit longer. Does it seem to matter anymore about the July 1 deadline?
Well, that's a good question. They have missed the July 1 deadline pretty consistently last year, and I think Costa's projection was sort of based on what they did last year when they did get the spend plan out earlier than the revenue plan. You know, that's speculation at this point whether it'll happen again. But, yeah, I mean, I think the general thought is that within a few weeks of June 30th is more or less okay. Again, I mean, 2 years ago we had a nine-month standoff, so
okay,
a lot
Katie.
Of things look good in comparison to that.
All right. Katie Meyer is Capitol Bureau Chief for WESA. Thanks so much, Katie.
Thank you.
And for this week, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Our engineer is Tom Hurley, production assistant and researcher Katie Zilkowski. The Confluence was produced today by Katie Blackley. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good week of good news.